Welcome to Basic Black. Some of you are joining us on our live broadcast, and others of you are joining us on Facebook Live and Twitter. I'm Callie Crossley, host of Under the Radar 89.7. Tonight, criminal justice reform. Supporters of criminal justice reform have long fought against policies promoting harsh sentences and mass incarceration. But in recent years, there has been movement toward new policies on the federal and, most significantly, the state level. In fact, other states are modeling their reforms based on the Massachusetts Criminal Justice Reform Bill passed 2 years ago, which includes alternatives to prison and reentry programs. Still, many who are caught up in the system are at risk for wrongful convictions, with people of color at greatest risk. Joining me tonight, Rahsaan Hall, director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU of Massachusetts. Yvonne Espinoza Madrigal, executive director of the Lawyers for Civil Rights in Boston. Philip Martin, senior investigative reporter, New England Center for Investigative Reporting, WGBH News. And Sean Ellis. Ellis was wrongfully convicted of a 1993 murder of a Boston police detective. After having spent nearly 22 years incarcerated, his conviction was overturned in 2015. And via Skype, Radha Natarajan, executive director of the New England Innocence Project. Welcome to all of you.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Now, this conversation about criminal justice reform is heavy, and there's a lot of stuff that still is left to do, much work to be done. But in fact, there is movement towards some new policies. And actually, in preparing for the show, I was a little surprised about how much movement is happening state by state, sure, and even at the federal level. So we need to mention the First Step Act that was signed by President Trump, of which he is quite proud of. That was pushed by a lot of different folks, many, many hands on that project. And then pay attention to all of the movements on the state level, as I mentioned, Massachusetts. Rahsaan, I'll just start with you. We're not where we're supposed to be, but compared to, let's say, 10 years ago, how would you assess the progress?
The progress is moving forward. It's moving in the right direction. There's this tension in the criminal law reform space. There are some people like myself and others who style ourselves as prison abolitionists. What we are advocating for is a society that we can live in that does not require putting people in cages and having armed men, which it mostly is, patrolling our streets to keep us safe. And so in the interim, the reform that we're trying to do is dismantle the system that currently exists and not replace it with things that will later have to tear down. So some of the reforms that have been made are good, like eliminating mandatory minimum sentences, increasing more opportunities for diversion, reforms to bail, making sure that people aren't being held in solitary confinement. But there are some other things that are happening, like in the increase of risk assessment tools that have very racist outcomes, or electronic monitoring and shackling, and broadening the footprint of the system and increasing more opportunities for privatization. So for as much as there has been some progress and more people are being released, it doesn't make a significant enough of a dent, and it creates more opportunities for abuse.
And Yvonne, one of the things that's interesting to note is that the data now we have enough data, it shows that mass incarceration does not create public safety, or the kind of public safety that was long touted by people who said, you know, the thing that you should do is three strikes, or make sure people are locked up, and that will make us safe. But now we have data that says, no, it doesn't.
Absolutely. Mm. The data bears out that harsher penalties, that resorting to incarceration is not making anyone more safe. As a matter of fact, intensive policing, especially in minority communities, has created mass distrust between people of color and other vulnerable communities, people who are afraid of coming forward as a victim, people who are afraid of coming forward as a witness because they don't trust law enforcement. And so you're absolutely right. We need to radically re-examine how we treat people at every facet of the criminal justice system, from the way police officers interact with people on the street all the way through how we prosecute people and how we sentence people, as Rasan was noting. And so at each of these steps, there is a high likelihood that there are racial disparities that's borne out by the data. And so the process is tainted, and we need to fix that.
Well, Sean Ellis, you're a living example of what happens when it's not fixed and when there are these built-in racial disparities and sort of targeting that puts people like yourself at greatest risk. So your story of being incarcerated since you were quite young, just share a bit of that.
Well, I think, you know, for the most part, everybody is well known as far as what led to my incarceration. But to focus on my fight to prove my innocence, that was very troubling due to the fact that, you know, the Commonwealth, the DA at the time, who was Dan Conley, he was very well aware of the corruption that exists in the case, the impact that it had on the evidence in the case. But instead of...
And by that means that was police corruption.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But instead of him stepping forward as a leader and taking accountability for the detectives that were involved in the case, he decided to spend another 10 to 12 years fighting a conviction that he knew was wrong to begin with.
Well, we've been talking about how this is the end product of being at risk for all of these policies that are left over and still in place, actually, mm-hmm. that have not yet been addressed by some of the reforms. Rod, I want to turn to you because you're head of the New England Innocence Project. So, as you said, you get hundreds of requests all the time from people saying, as Sean did, I did not do this. And yet they have a hard time accessing a system to be able to prove that they didn't do that.
Yes. I mean, I think as Rasan said, people want people have wanted a criminal punishment system. And so if there is a crime, they want someone to be arrested. They want someone to be prosecuted. That's at least how our society has functioned. And when there is need in our society, or when the society makes it happen, it's easy for them to select somebody. And that somebody may not be the person who committed the crime, but it's someone that they can arrest, they can prosecute, and they can forget about. Of course, their families, their communities don't forget about them. And after a very long time, it's not just them and the families that suffer in the community, but also the victims of the crime who learn that the right person was never prosecuted. And in fact, they never received justice. But yes, we receive hundreds of applications every year. And I don't necessarily see that the justice system, the criminal legal system, is actually ready to contend with that there are so many wrongful convictions.
And yet what is happening, Philip, is that because of some of the reforms that have been put in place in Massachusetts, other states, and even the First Step Act, more people publicly are aware, as Rada has said, mm-hmm. some of this stuff is wrong. And a lot of these people, in the ways that they weren't before, it was, as she said, put them away. That's fine. But now this, well, wait a minute, have we done, do we know for sure?
Well, that's a lot of awareness. I mean, you think about the documentaries that have come out, this mm-hmm. particularly 13th, which looks at the 13th.
Ava DuVernay's documentary.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And you also look at Bryan Stevenson's Just Mercy. Just Out. Yeah. And you find people are increasingly aware of disparities within the criminal justice system, concerned about bail, concerned about mandatory sentencing, and the backlash to the 1980s, if you will, in the 90s, where everything was criminalized, is in full stream right now. But at the same time, you see a reactionary a force taking place across the country against DAs who've been elected based on the proposition that they will reform the system. Mm-hmm. So recently in January, early January, you found DAs coming together, progressive DAs, including Rachel Rollins, having to go out to St. Louis to rally with other progressive DAs in support of the district attorney in St. Louis.
Who's under attack,
mm-hmm. who's had to sue, basically, to basically protect herself because she's received a plethora of racist email. Has been threatened. The same thing has been true with Rachel Rollins.
So we should say that the reason for that is that mm-hmm. they're implementing new kinds of policies as we discussed.
That's right. So the minute you're talking about reform, with reform you have a reaction, and that reaction has been both a positive reaction on the part of the broader public, but also forces who, including police unions, who feel threatened by this reform. You see a backlash to the backlash. You see a backlash to the very notion of reform, because the assumption is reform will in fact lead to more crime on the streets in places like New York, for example, in Massachusetts. Right. That's the argument.
Well, in fact, this organization, it's Prisoners Legal Services, sent out a note to legislators this week concerned that I'm not going to describe it as a riot, but it was a disturbance in a jail in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And the first response to it was, this is a result
That's
of criminal
right.
justice reform. Mm-hmm. And what they're saying is, no. We're urging our legislators to stand behind criminal justice reform and to understand that this is a pushback from people who really are uncomfortable with the reforms and seek to blame anything that is not going well on that. So that's very mm-hmm. important.
Absolutely, mm-hmm. and I fully agree that this backlash coming from the law and order elements, right? These historical elements that want to keep the status quo and are afraid of change is happening. That is a reality that's happening here and it's happening around the country. But at the same time, I do want to focus on the fact that right now, the reason why these reforms that we've been discussing have been able to come through is also because we are enjoying support from many different segments in a way that's very new. You know, you were saying before, Callie, 10 years ago, how would this have looked? Well, 10 years ago, we didn't have suburban families concerned that law enforcement was going to lock up their relatives because they're connected to the opioid epidemic, right? And so mm-hmm. this has sensitized people in a way that is very new and that has helped us push for criminal justice reform, for more accountability, more transparency, for a system that is more humane and a lot more manageable for families. And so I think it's important to see that not only have we disturbed some of the law and order types, but we are also, on the other side of things, enjoying more support from, let's say, suburban families or middle-class families that would not necessarily have seen themselves reflected in the criminal legal system, but whose relatives now are mm-hmm. because of the opioid epidemic.
And I want to add, to come back to Brian Stevenson's story, that his story and those kinds of narratives also add to opening up on a national way of to let people understand stories like Sean's. I mean, Sean's story is right here,
yeah.
but somehow this really makes it. So this is the new film, Just Mercy, which portrays the true story of Walter Johnny D. McMillan, wrongly convicted of murder and sentenced to death. His sentence was eventually overturned, but only after McMillan spent 6 years on Alabama's death row. McMillan's lawyer, Brian Stevenson, to whom I referred, wrote about his case in his memoir of the same name. The Just Mercy movie follows Stevenson's journey from Harvard Law School graduate to the founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative. Here's a clip.
They convicted an innocent man. I was always taught to fight for the people who need the help the most.
You don't know what it is down here. They ain't got to have no evidence.
How many of you all were with Walter that morning?
You ain't quitting, is you?
No, sir.
We all with you.
While your case, Sean, was overturned in the same way that this gentleman's was finally overturned in the struggle that Brian Stevenson had, this is very real, and the impact on the family and the community as is portrayed in that story, I think, helps people open up to know this is not something that happens every now and then. It's more common than we'd like to imagine.
It happens quite often. on any given day, I can be within the exoneree community just here in Massachusetts alone. And on any given day, it can be a number of three of us or four of us, although there's a lot more from the state. And the amount of years that we've spent behind bars could total 138 to 160. I know that somebody that I speak with often, Darryl Jones, he spent 32 years in prison. There's another guy that I communicate with, Nat, and he spent, I think, 16 years in prison. And Victor Rosario spent 32 years in prison. Myself, I spent 22 years in prison. So if you do the numbers, the amount of years that guys spend incarcerated for crimes that they haven't committed is astounding. But I also, I'm the only one on the panel that actually has, as a person, have gone through the entire criminal justice system from start to finish. And just kind of speaking back to the disturbance that happened at Susan Baranowski, what happened, it's, you know, it's unfortunate that it happened. But I was brought from MCI Walpole, where I maintained basically great behavior, and I was put at Susan Baranowski for no disciplinary reason. And I remained there for 9 years, and I've encountered some guards there that, you know, they come and they do their job and they go home. But then there is a element that seeks to incite the prison population. And like, I have strong reason to believe that that's really what kind of
led happened there
to that situation that happened.
Right.
So I just want to caution, you know, us to not just look at what happened as though it happened in the vacuum and there wasn't a root cause, so, you know, but.
And I also wanted to just bring up it because I need for you all to respond, because you have lived it, you all are working in it, and that, I can hear people saying now, people did crimes. You know, what's wrong with having a criminal justice system that addresses people who do crimes and make them pay for their time?
Sure.
So why are you all so softies on crime for people who did crime?
So I can speak from my perspective as 8 years as a prosecutor. I worked in Suffolk County District Attorney's Office, and I had that same mentality too, that this role and this system is actually keeping people safe. But like Yvonne was saying earlier, it actually ends up causing more harm because of the disruption in community. And one of the things that this system does, it does not create accountability. It generates punishment. When you look at some of the restorative justice practices and circle practices that are being done, having people come to grips with what it is they've done, how it has harmed their community, and how they can make their community and themselves and the person that they have harmed whole. Now, does that mean that we don't need incapacitation or restraint to some degree? No, it doesn't mean that. But the system as it exists, that has its roots in the racist history of this nation, is not the type of system that we need. And to Sean's point about Susan Baranowski, it is the behavior of those officers. There's empirical data that shows when you have more reform around solitary confinement, you end up with better outcome. There's ample data, like you were talking about, that says the system as it operates now isn't working, but the reforms will be better when you give people more opportunities to have a system and a process that is rooted in restoration, transformation, and healing.
Rada, I just wanted to have you weigh in on that. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that there's one side public safety and one side against public safety. I think that the criminal punishment system has been held up as the only one that is for public safety. But we've gone through decades of evidence to demonstrate that the way we do things in the United States, where we say, you know, they did the crime, they should do time, that's not working for public safety. It's not working for communities. In fact, it's tearing apart the very fabric of who we are. And if we look at other countries and how they deal with crime, we're not the only place in the world that has crime, but we're the only country that deals with it this way. And I think that the punitive system that we have is both flawed because it has wrongful convictions, like Sean and so many others, but in addition to that, the punishments don't work and are disproportionate and are just punitive.
And Philip, I know you wanted to, thank you, Roger. And before, I know you wanted to weigh in, but I want to just follow up on something that Rahsaan said, is that there are surveys, there is data that shows the drop in certain kinds of crimes, the drop in recidivism when these alternative policies are forward and the other ones are receding in the past. So, Philip.
Well, to that point, one of my concerns in covering these types of stories is whether or not we're actually seeing a broad structural change, or we're seeing bits and pieces. For example, you think about the FIRST Act, the First Step Act, which, as you said, the President Trump has heralded. My concern about that is, like, it seems like the First Step should actually be a broader look at criminal justice, as opposed to what seems to be bits and pieces nipping at around the edges of criminal reform. Another good example of this is in Oklahoma. Recently in Oklahoma, more than 300 people were basically paroled. Pardon. I'm sorry. They were pardoned. But the problem with that is, I went through the statistics. Even though Oklahoma's disproportionate number of Native American and Black folk behind bars, almost everyone who was paroled, pardoned, was white. Yeah. And I think that when we talk about reform, it has to be reform in a much broader structural manner than the types of media, if you will, media accented reform that we're experiencing.
I agree with that. Absolutely.
And in fact, Yvonne, the First Step Act is very important, mm-hmm. just because you need some federal legislation mm-hmm. going in that direction if you're trying to begin the process of reform. But the real reform has to take place at the state,
absolutely.
Because that's where we're on the ground with trying to make some of these changes.
Absolutely, and I fully agree about this patchwork, right? It's mm-hmm. it's really a Band-Aid that we're using. Here in Massachusetts, one of the things that my organization, Lawyers for Civil Rights, has been very actively doing is making sure that people do not get denied opportunities for employment, opportunities for education, opportunities for housing based on things that they did maybe 22 years ago or that they didn't even do, right? And so it's not just about how we are going through the criminal legal system, it is also how we treat people in terms mm-hmm. of reentry and collateral consequences of incarceration. And so any effort that is designed to reform needs to take those other elements into account, and it has to start at the state level because mm-hmm. it's state and local authorities that start the process of criminalization.
So let me circle back to something you said earlier, Yvonne, which was about certain other constituencies coming into contact with the criminal justice system and realizing, like these suburban families, we've seen quite a number of celebrities stepping forward, that, wait a minute, this is way more impactful than I thought in my own life, in people I know. And what that has meant and what that will mean as we go forward in terms of legislation. So now that you know it, are there people joining forces across constituencies to move together, or is it still, as Philip has just said, in a situation where there is reform, then the people who benefit the most are not the folks who are greatest at risk?
We need to do a lot more work to build those bridges, because a lot of this does happen more in isolation, right? My cousin shouldn't be criminalized in that way, but they're not taking a look at the way that other people who are being charged with other offenses are being treated. And so I think we need to create those connections. The narrative that we were talking about is very important, and we need to make sure that we are raising awareness of the implications of incarceration and the racial disparities. Raising awareness is critical to be able to continue to change hearts and minds about the problems surrounding criminalization. So you're right, we have new allies, but we need to connect them to the broader movement so that we're all speaking with one voice on all of these critical issues and not just the opioid epidemic.
I think one of the things that's really important is centering the voice of the people who are directly impacted. So having Sean Ellis on the show is eminently important. I think some of the sisters who are out here doing this work, like my friend Andrea James from Families for Justice is Healing, who was formerly incarcerated, because when we bring people who don't have the experience and are coming at it from the periphery, we get tinkering around the edges and we don't get to the core issues. We don't deal with the increasing rates of incarceration of women and girls that is exorbitant. And there's a conversation happening now about building a new regional housing facility for a new jail for women. And it's just like women who have been incarcerated are the ones who are leading the movement to dismantle that, because other people who aren't touched by it will say, well, that maybe makes sense to have something that's regional so it can be more convenient for people. But talk to the women who have been put in cages and they'll tell you a very different story about it.
Sean, I've got just a few seconds. What's the one thing you would like people to take away in terms of being aware from your story?
For being aware, for the people that's going through it, is they have to be part of it. They have to be invested in what's going on with their life. Like, I was at a position where I wasn't able to be invested in decisions that was being made that ultimately impacted me for 25 years.
So make sure you're in the mix in
Absolutely.
The conversation. All right. Well, that's the end of our broadcast and the end of our show. I want to thank all of our guests for being here, and thank you for joining us. Now, you stay with us right now as we continue our conversation on Facebook Live and Twitter.